The information in this broadcast is for educational purposes only and is not provided as a professional service, medical advice, or is it intended or implied to be a substitute for diagnosis or treatment. You are encouraged to confirm any information obtained from this broadcast with other sources and review all information regarding any medical condition or treatment with your physician and other appropriate healthcare providers.
Hi, I'm Pete Levine. Welcome to Noggins and Neurons, Stroke and TBI Recovery Simplified. I'm a clinical instructor and clinical researcher. I've co-authored dozens of scientific journal articles about brain injury recovery, and I'm also the author of the book, Stronger After Stroke.
I'm Deborah Battistella, occupational therapist, creator of the OT's Guide to Mirror Therapy, and an OT educator. I have a lot of experience working with survivors. Most of my clinical practice has been in a certified stroke center. Pete and I are especially interested in talking about what rehab, neuroscience, and clinical research all have to say about the brain and recovery. But don't worry, our job is to make this stuff simple.
We're here to make it so that everyone, clinicians, clinical students, caregivers, and most importantly, the survivor, understands what it takes to leverage their great neuroplastic brain for recovery.
This podcast began with both Pete and I, two kindred souls with a passion for moving the recovery process forward. If you've started listening more recently, say since the beginning of 2022, you likely noticed that Pete is absent from conversations. This is because he had a rather unexpected and abrupt departure from this earthly plane. Pete's voice remains in the intro in reference to and respect for his part of our joint vision for this project. Simply put, it wouldn't be where it is today, nor have a future without him. Now, on to another great conversation. Welcome to another great episode. I want to jump in quickly to let you know there are a couple of spots in this recording that have some feedback. They're not too long, but don't be alarmed when you hear that feedback. It's as quick as possible. I do apologize because we couldn't get rid of all of it, but the conversation is so good that we didn't want to not release because of it. So thanks for understanding and enjoy. Doro and I are here with Terry Cassidy, and Terry's going to talk to us about her occupational therapy practice. She specializes in many things, one of them that we're interested in, this very important topic of driving rehab, driving after stroke. So Doro, Terry, you will run the show here today, and I will be asking a ton of questions because I don't do driving. So welcome.
Sounds like a plan.
Thank you so much.
So we are connected through a mutual acquaintance, Suzanne Briggs, who did two wonderful episodes with us on vision rehab. And Suzanne connected us over a year ago, I'm going to say, and we're finally getting to meet you in person. And it's so nice to have you here. Let's have you start with telling us a little bit about yourself and your OT practice and how you got into the driving aspect.
Sure, that sounds great. Thank you. So yes, as you mentioned, I'm an occupational therapist and certified driver rehabilitation specialist. My career has really been in neuro rehab. So working in acute care in the hospital, acute rehab, and that's actually really where I first was interested in driving, mostly because my patients wanted to drive. Like, right? That's why we do driving. It's a goal of so many people in our society, whether they're in the hospital or not. And I didn't have an answer for them. And so really started looking around more and kind of through that process, got involved with CarFit, got involved with driver rehab, and moved to an outpatient position at the hospital. So I started the driver rehab program at the hospital, also doing neuro rehab in that outpatient setting. And then about 5 years ago, they closed the driver rehab program, which is kind of happening, has happened in other parts of our state as well. And so that's when I started a private practice. So it's been 4.5 years about that I've been seeing clients through Health Promotion Partners. And it's been an amazing journey and just honestly really cool to be able to do things the way I want to, in the way that makes the most sense for my clients. So my intro to driver rehab was really from this meeting the needs of my patients in the hospital. Certainly at this point, that has expanded and we see people of all ages and all diagnoses.
So I did. Cool.
So funny. Cool. I see so many parallels. I mean, for me, it happened exactly the same way, except I was an outpatient, but it was the same journey.
There's a need, right?
Absolutely.
And honestly, absolutely. Having done driver rehab now for 12 years, I still meet people every time I give a presentation who say, oh, I had no idea there was such a thing. Mm-hmm. Professionals, members of the public, oh, where were you when my dad had a stroke? You know, yep. All of these things that there still needs to be more awareness around. Absolutely. What we do.
Absolutely.
Yeah. It seems like no matter who you run into or how you try to bring awareness, that there still is a lack of awareness somehow. It's a pretty big world that we live in.
Yeah.
You said something important that I would love to touch on, and it may be a little disruptive to some people, but I think the key words that you said were meeting my people where they were, providing the service the way they need it provided. And it seems to be a common theme among people who prefer to provide a high quality service that there are limitations within a system. And I wonder if we could talk a little bit about that, compare the differences and help people understand why there may be some limitations within a system. And hopefully some people who work within a system will listen and think about maybe doing some things differently.
That's a really big question. That's huge. And that does get to kind of all kinds of philosophical beliefs that I have for sure. And I think as somebody, like you mentioned, like, interested in providing high quality care that's in the best interest of the patient and their recovery. Sometimes it's hard to be within a system that's defined by reimbursement, is one thing I would say. And sometimes those systems of management are not on the same philosophy or even profession as I am. And I think there's ways to work within a system to provide excellent care for sure. Some things like, so driving is a bit different because in general, it is not covered by Medicare. So, that honestly, in terms of starting a private practice, gave me some freedom right there in terms of being able to start out. So I feel like the differences, let's say, between hospital-based driver rehab and private practice driver rehab were a little bit more around scheduling, knowing more about my clients before they came, being able to do. So we do our evaluation in 3 hours, for the most part, a 3-hour chunk. And so just being able to have as much time as I needed and kind of split that up, however that client needed, I can. If endurance is an issue, we can separate it into two sessions. But so some of that is just the timing piece. And the training piece in the hospital setting, we kind of went back and forth with insurance reimbursement. Can insurance cover parts of it? And kind of went through a lot of changes over my time there. In our current practice, it is not completely private pay. We do work with the VA. We do work with the Brain Injury Alliance. We have contracts with PACE organizations. So we have worked hard to find a lot of funding sources, but those are generally not commercial insurance companies. I mean, just kind of the blunt part of that is it does give us more freedom to really reach out to see the client in their home if that's what they need to do, just be a little more creative in our practice.
Okay, I'm just trying not to hog the show here.
No, go right ahead.
you said some important things, beliefs, you know, your personal philosophical beliefs. And one of the things that we as occupational therapy practitioners carry around with us are our own beliefs. Even though a lot of us think that we're not letting our beliefs influence our practice, we are, because it's part of who we are. And it sounds like you got creative with your practice and being able to serve people who have access to benefits. So creativity, maybe sometimes people hold a belief that we can't do this. If we can't do it this way, then we can't do it at all. And so opening up to investigating what resources are out there, who does reimburse for those, and connecting with the people who have those benefits.
Yeah.
One thing that popped out at me.
And that's been a journey. You know, those things aren't easy. Even finding funding sources and building those relationships, honestly, navigating how to be reimbursed from these organizations that are not traditionally medical billers. And that's the piece that I feel like I am able to put the time and effort into because of my current position, as opposed to being 100% patient care.
Yeah, the time factor is really important. Where you're going to put your time in. The other thing you mentioned is PACE programs. You want to talk a little bit more about that?
I would love to. Yeah. So just so everybody's on the same page, PACE stands for Programs for All-Inclusive Care of the Elderly. So a national program, and then there's local, I don't know, vendor of the programs. I don't know if that's how it's explained. But I have a good relationship with the PACE program in our town here. And then we have since expanded at our Denver office. We have contracts with two other PACE organizations in the Denver area. And something I love about just the model of PACE is that it really is all-inclusive care, like the name says. And so the occupational therapists on the PACE team are really invested in this person, whether they have a quote-unquote rehabilitation need or not, or that's at least how I interpret it. So it's more of a almost a primary care model to me. And they are really the ones who are identifying participants who would benefit from a driving evaluation or driver training. So, which is great that they have that ability, and they honestly write the order for it too. And so it may be an older adult who is struggling cognitively, maybe nothing diagnosed specifically, but the therapist just wants to make sure that they're still safe to drive. You know, we certainly see people after an amputation or a stroke or a brain injury, like a more kind of concrete medical diagnosis. Something that's really great is that our partners in PACE sometimes are able to come to our evaluation. So they are able to offer, because they have a pretty flexible schedule also. And then they can carry over, because driving's not just a one-day thing. Like, our evaluation might be a one-time session, but there's always recommendations. There's often the car transfer piece of things. If there's equipment that's being recommended, and if the equipment's driving equipment, we will see them again. But it's just fantastic to know that there's professionals involved in this person's life that will be able to follow up, because plenty of people we see through PACE have a lot of complicating factors in their lives. So driving is one piece, but then also, where are they going to park this adaptive vehicle, and how are they going to get from their apartment to the vehicle? It's great to have a partner that's able to go to their home and do those pieces with them. So it's been really cool.
I have to look up PACE now.
You should.
I've heard of PACE, but it's a different organization. It's not for the elderly. I've heard of a PACE for younger people. So I'm definitely going to have to look it up and see if we have anything here. Yeah.
I would imagine so. It is generally for people who are dual eligible for Medicare and Medicaid. So it is more low income older adults.
I absolutely love that. And I think a lot of times as OT practitioners, it's easy to get stuck thinking about what interventions to work on with a person, especially if you've known them for a little while. There is so much that they can glean from the evaluation that a person has with you, and then provide these very specialized treatment plans individualized to that person to help keep them as independent as possible.
That's a great point. Wouldn't it be great if we could have somebody involved with all of it, somebody we see, somebody to go home and carry it on?
Absolutely. Carryover seems to be the biggest struggle. It seems to be a big struggle for people because of how habituated we become over the course of our lives. I was working with someone recently and they didn't do the thing that we had talked about the last time I saw them. And I said, do you know why? And they just said, no, I don't know. And they laughed. And I kind of had to laugh because how am I any different? You know, it's like, oh yeah, I want to do this thing. And then I think about it a week later, you know, so there is a big role for OT in the whole carryover piece.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, you bring up the point of that an OT who's already working with that person might still learn from our evaluation. And I appreciate that insight because that did happen last week. We had the therapist from PACE and he was like, just because it's different, like you said, they've worked with them for a long time, maybe in short blips, but here we're maybe asking just different questions. But I think one beauty or something I really value both in the hospital setting and private practice is the amount of time that I get with my client. And so when I'm setting aside an hour and a half for a clinical evaluation, it really doesn't happen in many other settings. And so we're able to go more deeply into the occupational profile. We're able to just get more information about their driving habits, what they want out of driving. So the OT that was there was like, oh, you didn't tell me that. I didn't know that part. And so he was like, I'm really glad I was able to be here for this piece of it. And I would say that's often true of families also. It's not that often that we have occupational therapists observe, but families are really grateful to be able to observe the clinical driving evaluation.
Yeah, that's such an important part. And I've noticed that more and more recently as we've gotten more and more elderly, that even though a family member provides care to their elderly mom or dad, during our evaluation, so many things come up and out that the child had no idea about. So it's very interesting to see how deep we can dig. And to us, it's not digging deep, right? To us, it's just getting to know the person.
Yeah, it just naturally comes out.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, being interested and knowing the types of questions to ask, and a lot of it is related to observational skills and then results that you see from assessments. And it's not magic. It's the way that we're trained to think. I also want to say something about the PACE program in that the all-inclusive care piece and the caring that you mentioned. I had the good fortune to fill in sometimes at a PACE program back in Buffalo, and I was blown away. Every person who was a part of that program in terms of the providers knew everything about the participants and cared about them. And could you go see if we have a tub transfer bench? And if we do, can you run it on over to Mrs. So-and-so's house? Can I do that? Yes. It's just so... it was so easy. Yeah.
It is such a good model in that sense to have somebody who knows this person over an amount of time. And also this idea, I feel like we can try to convince our clients that, for example, investing in a driving evaluation is in their best interest, is going to save them whether it's stress or worry or help them make decisions that are going to impact their health, of course, but our healthcare system is still not developed for prevention. And so PACE is a nice example of they financially benefit by keeping everybody well. And to some extent, that's true of our medical system, but it's still pretty reactive. And so I feel like supporting these programs that, yes, help find out the right boundaries for this person to be driving, for example. Maybe it is a 3-mile radius, but if they're still able to get to the grocery store, that's going to make a big difference in their quality of life, in their mental health, probably even in their physical mobility. And so it's a different lens a little bit, I feel like.
For sure. You just said something very important, the boundaries around which this person can drive. I wonder if you and Dora would be able to speak to that a little bit, because sometimes we have enough knowledge to think, oh, they shouldn't be driving, but that's not enough understanding around a person's ability to drive and maintain their independence with a certain diagnosis.
Yes, that's, as you know, within OT, there's a lot of, I feel like there's a lot of gray. But this is one of them that isn't discussed that often. You know, family members who call the client who's had a stroke, like, can I drive or not? And I think everybody thinks it's kind of this black or white decision. And people always, I don't know, I want to say relieved to learn that there's a couple possible outcomes from this evaluation. And one of them is training, but another is pass with restrictions. Making recommendations for restrictions is not something we take lightly, because there needs to be a certain level of ability to phone patterns, like you were saying, right? So to carry through with those, even just from a habitual standpoint. So developing those, but a lot of times we're reinforcing patterns that somebody's already doing and making it more efficient. So for example, a common restriction would be no night driving, no interstate driving. A lot of my clients do not need to drive to, like, so we're about an hour and a half south of Denver. A lot of them don't need to get on the interstate and drive to Denver as part of their daily routines, or they do it once a year and we can help them find somebody else to do that trip. So identifying restrictions that work for their life, but also match what we're seeing as their capabilities in terms of how fast they're going, how much traffic there is. And like you said, taking into consideration their diagnosis, I think is an important part of what we do. And really from the perspective of, I like to think of it as like a hybrid plan. And this is maybe more on the older adult side, but this idea of like, we're hopefully, if we live long enough, we're all going to need to stop driving at some point. This idea of this driving life expectancy. But for all of us, it's really rough to just stop something abruptly. And so if we can help people, if they can come see us early enough in their transition to where we're helping them make decisions around, okay, I don't drive on the interstate anymore, but I can still get to these places. And then maybe over time that changes. The hybrid part is still doing driving that's important to them that we think is safe for them to be doing, but then finding other alternative transportation for those other trips. So starting to incorporate Uber and Lyft, starting to incorporate the bus where they live, but not have to completely stop independent transportation and completely move to being a passenger. Having a period of time where they're able to transition, I think just makes sense.
Yeah, and the transition I feel is so important for the client, for the psychological well-being. A lot of these elderly clients, that's the only thing, the only independence and piece of freedom they have. They might live in assisted living, and having those keys, even though they only drive once a week to go to church on the weekend, or if we have to tell them it's time to look for other things, that the world breaks down. So I love incorporating that transition piece where you start slowly, if possible.
When possible, true.
When possible, yeah. Yeah, in Florida, it's a little bit harder with the restrictions. We can't really restrict for no highways legally. We could recommend it, but restrictions on the license, we really only can restrict daytime driving. Yeah, that's about it when it comes to where they can drive. So usually with good insight, when the client and the family member are supportive and they have good insight, then we're good to go and say, you're going to be okay in the back roads, you know, take the neighborhood streets. They have no ambition to drive on the interstate. But if we have somebody that where we feel like they might end up on the interstate, that's where we have to make that decision with them.
Yes.
And that's okay. The toughest one.
We do have a bit more flexibility. And I say we in Colorado, it's through the doctor. So back to the referring physician for any of the changes, but it can be added to someone's license to have a 5-mile radius from home as their restriction, which sometimes is perfect. You know, sometimes that really works out well.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I would think that might matter where someone lives. If someone lives in an extremely rural area, that might be a big challenge.
And honestly, because sometimes the restriction would be roads that are under 50 miles per hour. And sometimes the biggest challenge to that is that where their facility is or their home is a road that's over that. So as with everything, it's very individualized.
You said something else that I wonder if we can touch on. You were talking about the person who they need to retire from driving or they need to take a long trip and you can find help to get them there. How do you navigate that?
That part's really hard, we'll just say. There's not great easy options, basically, especially for longer trips, even from here to Denver. There's some buses and things like that. Most often it's family that steps in for that. I have had clients, I mean, one gentleman who said we did the driving evaluation and came back and I was explaining to him that it was time to stop driving. And he said, so you're saying I need a chauffeur? And I said, yes. He said, okay. I was like, oh, hey, we can do that every time. So some people have some resources.
I wish it was that easy all the time. That's excellent.
Wouldn't that be good?
Since you brought up the bus, I think that could be a whole level of training. I know I have worked with people who were needing to start taking like a paratransit, a more specialized system. And that can be very difficult to navigate if you have never done that before. I find that type of a system to be extremely overwhelming. Like that is anxiety inducing for me.
Yeah. I think it's depend on where you live, but I think a lot of our culture is not real geared around public transportation. And so for clients, some of it is the cognitive piece of navigating the schedules and the timing, and then the buses don't match up, or there's a 2-hour wait between buses. There's the physical piece, of course, which maybe is why they're coming to us in the first place. But there's also just a real cultural piece of whether people are willing to take the bus or not. And so I think there's definitely a role for occupational therapy in this community mobility side of things. I don't see it happening as often as I would like. And some of that might be funding related. And maybe also, like you're saying, it's daunting. And often we'll say like the individuals who are not appropriate to be driving, those same limitations may be keeping them from public transportation.
100%.
And that's where I feel like having an OT involved is really important.
When I listen to you talk, I think how beneficial it would be to consult with people in charge of the bus schedules, creating a schedule that is not visually overwhelming, creating a schedule and a system that is understandable to all of us. You know, sometimes they make these schedules, it's impossible to figure out what does this mean. Like you need a whole directory just to understand the system.
There are some good things happening. I've met some occupational therapists in, I want to say Philadelphia, maybe, that are employed by the transit system. And it's a little bit more on the paratransit side, you know, a little bit more for physical disability. But they're able to work with individuals one-on-one. I don't know if they're able to change bus schedules. That's a really interesting question. But there are some cool examples. We just need more of it.
For sure. The other thing that you mentioned that I found very intriguing is help with making decisions. I find decision-making to be very difficult for some people. Some people, yeah, they'll just make a decision. They know what they need to do. But other people struggle with that whole piece. So do you want to talk a little bit more about helping with that?
Sure. I feel like, and I will often explain to clients and families, like my role here. So let's, for example, somebody who's had a stroke, who's coming to us for driving. My role is to help you and your family and your doctor make decisions around driving. And the piece that I'm adding, certainly in terms of the objective evaluation and knowing this person, in the sense of an older adult, sometimes the discussion is, my role is to help you decide when to stop driving. The trick is that exact point is, it's pretty difficult. You know, we can't predict the future. So we're just trying to make decisions based on risk factors. And so in some sense, I say we're helping families make decisions because I can write a report that says fit to drive, not fit to drive. That doesn't necessarily mean they're going to do that. And so acknowledging that, my goal is more to certainly have the objective report, send that to the doctor, but spend time with the family and the client to understand why I'm making those recommendations. Because ultimately, I feel like it's the family and the client that are going to have to live with this every day. And we know there are plenty of people without a valid license that still get in their car and drive. So yes, on one level, it is the doctor decision, the state decision to cancel someone's license. There was this interesting study. It's not real recent, but it was in regard to traumatic brain injury in particular and driving. And they found that whether that person got back to driving or not really was in the hands of the primary caregiver. In a sense, you know, so even if this person passed the driving evaluation, if the caregiver wasn't, for whatever reason, supportive, if they were nervous about it or whatever it was, that person often didn't fully get back to driving and vice versa. So I think it's, we have a large responsibility here, but a lot of it is helping those decisions stick. So like every day, this person is going to have to, I mean, back to the restrictions topic, I'm hesitant to offer restrictions if it seems like a situation where the spouse is going to have to be enforcing those, and that's not a healthy situation for that couple. So ultimately, we're trying to help them make decisions and then also fit to those decisions.
I appreciate what you're saying, because I think sometimes that when you're on the receiving end of the decision making, if you're the person who's being told driving with restrictions, no driving, or even the family, they think that it's easy to think that it is this black and white thing, and it's not. And you're talking about all of these components that you're very aware of related to that person's life, which is why when you have that relationship with your client and you can build that rapport, they can feel like you're on their team, because you are on their team. But as a professional, there's a responsibility to do the responsible thing.
Yeah, that's a great point, though. That rapport is essential. And like I said, a lot of times we're just seeing the client this one time. But even like with that, we need to take advantage of every moment that we have to build a relationship in that 3-hour time block, primarily for that reason, so that our recommendations are at least listened to. And there's a lot of great, great family members that come to evaluations and will sit there with their spouse or their father and say, I'll kind of explain kind of the outcome. And then they'll say, Dad, will you repeat back what she just said? Like, there's this. And sometimes it's not at all what I just said, especially if there's nuances. Or often people don't understand, it's very self-protective, don't want to hear what they consider bad news. And so they'll be like, I know you told me not to drive, but I can still go to the store. You know, like it's just this piece that's really worth digging in and getting a little bit more on what their take is.
That is a very important point, because we know what we mean when we're talking to someone. And how often do we check to see what their understanding is? Wow. So since this podcast is largely about stroke and brain injury recovery, I wonder if we should talk about some in-clinic assessments that you use. What are you looking for with a person who has had a stroke? Why would someone who has had a stroke come and see you for a driving evaluation? Or I'll let you take it from there.
Sure. Yes, happy to talk about that. Our clientele, like when I look back at our statistics, and we have three locations along the Front Range in Denver, or in Colorado, and we just have some on our initial paperwork, there's a place where a person can identify why they're coming in. So looking at that, about 60% of our clients have had a stroke, which was shocking to me when I kind of went through and looked at it, because honestly, that's not necessarily what stands out the most. Sometimes the more emotionally charged evaluations stand out the most, and that might be the clients with dementia. And then brain injury is probably a large second to that stroke population. So I think it is great to kind of specify that we really do a lot of outreach to medical professionals, in particular to rehab therapists, to be talking about the importance of driver rehab as part of their practice on the inpatient side, for example. And I feel like that that over the years has gone a long way. So I think we also work in conjunction with outpatient occupational therapists. So for example, I had mentioned we'll do a 3-hour evaluation if we're doing the whole thing. We also do what we call an abbreviated evaluation, where the outpatient OT, and we have a partnership with them. We have a list of ones that we've kind of done training with, and they kind of know what paperwork we expect and things like that. They will do a good portion of what we would do in our clinical testing over the course of their outpatient therapy. And so when they're referring the client to us, we're doing a 2-hour evaluation instead of 3, saving the client some money in that process. And I think it's great in that therapist has been seeing this person over time, so they can give us some great insight also. We'll do about a 30-minute in the clinic in that example, and then about 1 hour in the car, as we typically do, and then come back and discuss. So trying to pull in information and resources as best we can. I know that didn't get to your question of tests, but...
Well, I love that because I have seen in some OT groups that I'm in on Facebook, people are asking questions about what can they do in their clinic towards the driving end of things. And if they could take care of those in-clinic assessments, do a little bit of education on driving rehab, I mean, that is helpful.
I think it's huge. I think a lot of my outreach, I guess, has been around educating occupational therapy practitioners about their role in driving, because it's really not just up to the specialist, I don't think. And there's so much, particularly with stroke and brain injury, that can be prepped ahead of time, right? Like I used to, when I was in outpatient, I would always say, so much of rehab is often, at least historically in the past, so much of rehab is kind of like right tabletop, like right in front of you. And so much of driving is up and out. And so however I can encourage outpatient therapists to do more dynamic, more multitasking, more things that are going to impact this person's community mobility, whether it's driving or not, I feel like we're setting our patients up for success in a good way. And like you mentioned, so often the therapists are coming to us saying, my patient wants to drive and I don't know what to tell them. So providing them some education in terms of how to be addressing driving, then we're all working toward that same goal.
One of the guests that we had on our show was Bridget, and she was a care partner to her husband who had a stroke. And she brought up this point of needing repetition, everything being explained. Start and make it clear and just keep telling us over and over and over again, because the entire situation, especially in the acute side of things, is very overwhelming for everybody because they don't know what's happening with their loved one. And you know, I worked in intensive care units for many years, and I often had the driving conversation with people. And, you know, you can't say it too soon. Start talking about it with them, answer their questions. So many people have questions in the intensive care unit and they want to know what's going to happen, and just start telling them what's involved, you know, whatever it is that's relevant to their question. And I always tried to give a resource. So I always would recommend where people could go in the community that I lived in at the time for driving evaluation. And I think then at some point they will start to absorb the information.
I completely agree. And I'm so glad to hear you say that. And I think there's mirrors with older adults too, is have the conversation often and early, I think kind of across the board, but in particular in a rehab setting, I have a lot of clients who come and I'll ask how they heard about us and say, well, my PT on rehab mentioned it. And then my doctor mentioned it. And then my outpatient there. And I'm like, oh, good. We're doing our job with like saturating the community a little bit, but all for good. Like I've seen clients in the outpatient setting. I was not seeing them for driving. This one woman in particular, she had had brain surgery. I was seeing her for vision. She had a hemianopsia. And I just, as part of my eval, was like, I'm guessing that you're not driving, like just kind of assuming that she wasn't driving, but figured I should ask. And she was like, well, not anymore. So I got home. And she said, I got home from the hospital. You know, she was in the hospital 2 days, 3 days, got home and drove with her husband. And luckily he was in the car and he starts freaking out. And she's like, what? And so he tells her to pull over and he's like, can you not see those vehicles and all this stuff? And to me, I'm like, what went wrong here? Like, where was our breakdown in this person's continuum of care? And it was at the hospital where I was working. I went back and looked at her acute care OT note and it was great. It was a great evaluation. She had talked about vision. She had identified the hemianopsia. As you guys are probably well aware, that often doesn't sink in. Vision deficits don't sink in very well, at least initially. But nowhere was there a mention of don't drive. There was no mention of what I'm always encouraging therapists, just if there's some deficit, at least say don't drive until you see your primary doctor. At least mention the word driving. In that case would have been super helpful. And I feel like there's therapists, so I love that you said in the ICU, because the therapists would say, oh no, I don't do that. I don't do driving. Talk to your doctor. And I feel like we're doing a disservice to our clients when we end up in that situation. So I am always encouraging therapists to bring it up because your patient's thinking it, even if you're not. And also from that example, I feel like our rehab clients, for example, we're used to seeing them as they were presenting at their functional level on the rehab unit. They go home. They're used to being at home when they were in their prior level of function. Their keys are hanging up. Their car's in the garage. They need something at the store. They're not necessarily thinking, oh, but my right arm's not working as well as it used to. And my vision's a little off. You know, like we're not there with them. So I think it's understandable that clients, especially if it's not addressed earlier, will just go drive and not think anything of it.
Yeah, well, the first time you see a person as part of your evaluation questionnaire, I think it's important to find out who do they live with? How do they get around? What were they doing? That whole prior level of function includes activities that they were involved in. And getting food is a big deal, especially for someone who lives alone or someone who's a care partner for someone. That right there is the indication that they were going out of the home independently, most likely. And I think it comes with the level of experience. Being a practitioner, you start to realize the importance of addressing these things right away. I know for myself, so many continuing education courses that I attended over the years, you could tell when you had the wise practitioner being the instructor, because they would encourage you to start from day one, even if you're in a rehab setting or in the hospital. For certain things like driving, people who have a diagnosis of dementia, keeping that field of view wide because it starts to shrink over time. They start to shrink. What can you do now? It's important to address those things for the next phase of their recovery. Nora?
One thing I would love to mention, because I really didn't talk about assessments or any of that, and I'm happy to if you guys have any particular questions, but there is a resource I'd love to share with you guys, and you can put it in your show notes, called the Generalist Resource to Integrate Driving. So this has ended up being kind of a COVID project for some colleagues and I, and developed a sheet really for therapists, for occupational therapists in the continuum of care. It could be acute care, rehab, outpatient, based on the OT drive model. So this idea of kind of triage of red, yellow, green levels of safety in regard to driving. So for each test, so for trail making, for example, we have kind of, these are the scores that we would consider in the green category. These are the scores we would consider in the at-risk category. And these scores we consider in the red category. The idea is both to give ideas of assessments and scores that we typically see based on research and also based on clinical experience, but also with this idea that not everybody needs to see a specialist in driving. There are people that can determine that this person's not going to be safe to drive without them coming to see a specialist. And, you know, that might be moderate to severe dementia. It might be, there's a lot of times when that could happen. But this grid kind of gives some more information to that decision-making, and then also a way to discuss driving with the client to say, all of your scores are in the red. Let's choose some of these to work on before we send you for a driving evaluation.
That sounds like the driving risk calculator.
Similar. In some ways, for sure. Yeah. Yep.
This is wonderful. I think I just found it.
Oh, cool.
So it says Assistance for Life Care Management Services, that one.
Ooh.
Older driver safety, what can occupational therapy generalists do? And it's got a stoplight.
Maybe that's in a different form. I'll try to find out.
Okay. Here, I'll stick the link in the
chat. Put it in the chat. I want to look at it too.
I know you do. there it is. I'm chatting as a guest, apparently. Okay. There you go.
I love using tools like what Terry just said, where you have the green, yellow, red type categories to show the clients. That way you can kind of deflect it off you a little bit. A lot of clients get upset and angry, and that way you can show them, look, according to research, this is what's being said. It's not me. I really want you to be okay. I want you to drive, but I don't think you should based on this. It helps families understand it as well.
I think the visual,
absolutely.
The visual is so helpful,
yeah.
Because I think we sometimes forget that a lot of what we see or what we hear, we interpret into images.
Yes.
And words can get lost, especially for somebody who has some slower processing, you know, education level, socio-demographics.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A lot of times the tests we do in our driving evaluation, a lot of clients don't understand how it relates to driving. So to them, it's just like, okay, you made me connect dots, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and then letters and dots. And now you tell me I can or I cannot drive. So I feel like it's super important to really explain how this task or each assessment relates to driving. And then when you have it on a piece of paper with research that backs it up, it's helpful.
Yeah.
That's a really good point. And I do feel like having that explanation ready, and not even just for the therapist doing the driving evaluation, but for OTs in the outpatient setting, because maybe they're the ones that are convincing somebody that they should come for a driving evaluation. And I just remember when I was on the rehab unit, just starting to learn about driving, the way I explained the assessments I was doing changed so much the more I learned about how they relate it. Like, so for me, the MVPT was one of those that I did, but I started doing more and talking about the research linking some of these pieces to driving. And people were shocked, right? This possibly have to do with driving, but they were also intrigued enough to keep working on it. So I think sometimes it can be used as motivation also. But the visual is a good idea. And it kind of makes me think of how I could be doing that even more in my practice, because we do a report, but not at the time of the discussion. It would be interesting to have some kind of graphic that we have bring out for that discussion with the client and their family. I like that.
You know, as I'm one of those people, I like charts. I like decision tree types of things, and I find them beneficial to start thinking. But sometimes there are things that don't fit within those parameters that you put on your decision tree or your graphic or something. And, you know, just figuring out a way to help people understand what you're trying to convey to them. I think it goes a long way towards building that trust factor with your clients, because when they see you putting the effort into helping them understand and seeing how you're trying to help them, they appreciate that.
So important. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we saw a huge difference in how clients accepted our decisions once we pulled out the driving risk assessment. We printed it out and we filled all the scores in as we went through the evaluation to then show them you're in green, orange, or the red category. And then would tell them before we even got behind the wheel, it's like, okay, based on this, you're iffy, but let's get behind the wheel. It might look totally different. Let's start in a closed course, safe environment. And then we go from there. And yeah, it gave them a whole different perspective versus us keeping the scores in our head and interpreting for ourselves and then presenting the final result at the end. So it just gave them more access and be a part of the whole process from the beginning.
Nice, I like that. And Deb, that image that was in the chat, is a great one. That is the OT drive model. So kind of what both the grid and the driving risk calculator are based on. That's kind of the philosophical model. And that's a great image to use also.
So, okay, good. Is yours this one that says free grid generalist resource to integrate driving?
Probably.
I'm going to pull this one up and see. Uh-huh. Adaptive mobility services?
Yes.
Okay.
And I think the idea with the grid is really for the generalist. So it can be used, like I mentioned, in different levels of care. I think the driving risk calculator is a little more specific to like making a decision about driving. Would you say that's accurate, Laurel?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So they're both great things to use in different settings, maybe.
I'm glad that you brought this up, because I think sometimes OT practitioners struggle to make that connection. I just did this assessment. What is this really telling me about a person? So you mentioned the trail making test, Doro. Mm-hmm. Do you use that one as well, Terry?
Yes. Yes, certainly.
So that's a good assessment tool that someone in an outpatient setting can use. They're likely using it already for other mm-hmm. things.
We do. Let's see. I'm going to tell you what we do and then we can share notes, Terry. Range of motion and strength, of course, sensation in upper and lower extremities. We do coordination. We do brake reaction time. We do, for the paper testing, we do the trails, the maze test. We do... we do the slums or the MoCA. What else do we do? That's all I can think of right now. And then we do the vision test with a OpTech.
I would say pretty similar for sure. And you know, I'm always describing it to clients as like, we're going to be looking at physical, we're going to look at vision, we're going to look mm-hmm. at cognition broadly.
Yeah.
We use the BCAT often for cognitive testing. Mm-hmm. Just gives us a little more information. We do use the MoCA also, or the short blessed sometimes when there's a dementia diagnosis. But all the similar topics that you're covering, I think for us, I mean, as you know, stroke... the deficits from a stroke or the impacts of a stroke can be so varied.
Different. Yes.
And so we're really pulling out things particular to that client. So there's kind of that core list, like you mentioned.
Yeah, that's what we do too.
We do a lot with vision. We will sometimes look at binocular vision. I have a history of doing a lot of vision rehab in the outpatient setting. So that's something I really like to look at in particular. We'll bring in the Bell's test, for example. I'll do line bisection if there's any concern about either visual neglect or a visual field cut. I think, Deb, based on, or back to what you were saying about, like, a lot of clinicians want to know which test to use and how they impact driving, I think my hesitation sometimes with any of these grids or lists of assessments is that somebody will do an assessment and make a decision based on that one test or two tests. And that's, I think, really where more knowledge and experience in the driver rehab setting plays a role in terms of, ultimately, it's all of these things together, plus all of the, it comes down to clinical judgment, I guess, is the biggest thing I can say. And I think even sometimes going into driving as a specialty, we want to know what are the cutoff scores. And I feel like the more people we work with, the more we realize it's not so much about the score. Like, those scores guide us. And exactly like you said, Dora, we can look at this chart and say, okay, I'm a little nervous on this, or this is something I'm going to be looking at in the car. And I would never go do the drive without doing those pieces.
Yeah.
But it's not one test score. And that's where it really, to me, is a field that needs an occupational therapy practitioner at the helm, because we look at environment, we look at the social factors, we look at the physical and cognitive, and really bring those together with a decision for that client.
Yeah.
As opposed to someone giving a MOCA in a doctor's office and saying, don't drive. Like, there's such a stark difference.
Yeah, it's such a good point you just made. So important.
Yeah. When I listen to what you two are saying, and I think about what I've learned over the course of my career, I think if you have an interest in something, then you should learn about it. And, it, you know, take some continuing education, but also interact with all of the people who play a role in that particular person's life for this particular topic for driving. So get to know, what does the driver evaluation look like? What are you looking for in the vehicle? And start to get a feel for that. Understand that whole big picture, because it's easy to have that narrow view for the setting that you're working in. But if you truly want to help someone, then having an understanding of the whole picture is essential. And I tell this story often, but one of the jobs that I had that I really disliked the most gave me the best training. And I went with someone from every discipline for a day to see what they did. And then I started to understand what everyone was looking at in terms of this person's care, in terms of the needs that they had to support them living at home in order to rehabilitate them to their highest level of function. And, you know, I mean, I was a newer therapist. I had been a therapist for a while, but I still didn't understand that full picture. And it helped me throughout the rest of my career.
That makes so much sense. Yeah, that's great. And it makes me think of one piece when we were talking about private practice, kind of way. One of those pieces that I feel like I have more freedom of is having people shadow. At the hospital, it was really difficult. They'd have to become a volunteer and all of these things. So we have a pretty robust program of, I mean, we take level one fieldwork students, we take capstone students, but we also have professionals that, you know, come out. I mean, they PT, OT, we had a researcher. We're often inviting people, just like you're saying, come shadow an evaluation. You'll have such a better understanding of even how to talk to your client about it afterwards than if we just tell you about it. And so it's lovely to be able to offer that. And I feel like we all benefit from that collaboration too.
100%. Yeah. And I feel like What I would like to encourage the generalist to do right now is, if you are that person doing some of these assessments, don't make the decision for driving until you speak with someone like Doro or Terry or the driver specialist in your area, because it's a person's life that's being impacted. And we want to make sure that they really do have the opportunity to live to their highest potential.
There's one other thing I would love to add, if I may, and I know we're going on time here. Just in regard to stroke and brain injury in particular with driving, I would say those are the two diagnoses that we are most often suggesting or recommending some training for. Aside from if someone needs adaptive equipment, that's a little bit of a different topic. But we have seen a lot of individuals who come. Well, one question is, how soon after stroke should I do a driving evaluation? And I have some therapists that have definite ideas on that. However, everybody is so different. And I tell our admin staff, you know, they'll be like, oh, this person said they're only a month out. What should we do? I'm like, well, are they driving? Like, if they're currently driving, yes, come in now. If they're open to waiting, then wait a bit. But we will see people who do not pass the evaluation that first time around. And I feel like part of our responsibility, part of our skill, is to make this determination of rehab potential. So there are people we see who've had a stroke and then there's new cognitive deficits, and sometimes they look more like dementia. And so I feel like we're trying to tease out, what do I reasonably expect to improve and what may not improve? So I would say we see people do the drive even and notice deficits, and our recommendation is go back to outpatient occupational therapy. We have some very specific things that we're going to recommend you and your therapist work on. Come back in 3 months. And I would say, I mean, that's not a majority of clients, but that definitely can happen. And I just want to caution people to leave room for that recovery that hasn't happened yet. And maybe they need a different style of therapy. Maybe they need a different setting. But giving people that opportunity. And sometimes, honestly, what needs to happen is training in the vehicle. Sometimes that's the only way to fully get the multitasking level of complexity, is by coming back and doing training with us. So that's just a big part of what I think of with stroke in particular, as well as brain injury, is that rehab potential is a really important piece.
Agreed.
I agree too. And towards the end of the survivor, I know sometimes when things happen in people's lives, they want to get back to their life right now. And there is that healing time that continues to happen. And so to all the therapists, I know that the people who listen, the therapists, the practitioners who listen to this podcast, they don't ever tell people their healing is done. But I know that does happen sometimes. Healthcare professionals will tell people that they've reached their potential and this is where they're at. We know that's not true anymore. And we know that some healing occurs over extended periods of time. So trying to find that place of patience with yourself is really important. Can be difficult, but very important.
Absolutely. And then there's the clients that I've done an evaluation with, we recommended they wait, they come back and they say, you know, I didn't realize how foggy I was then, but now that I'm out of it, I can see where you were coming from. I'm glad I waited, you know? So it is that insight piece that develops over time. Maybe insight's not the right word, but this feeling of, oh, this is not just my new normal. I can still feel better beyond this point.
Yeah. It's a big thing that happens. So we talked about driver rehab. We talked about driver evaluations. We talked about assessments. We talked about different programs of people that you can partner with. I think that the world is moving more towards partnership and collaboration. So that part makes me really happy. I'm excited for all the potential that is out there. What have we missed?
The only other piece that I would like to mention is new drivers. We do a readiness to drive program, and it's really, I don't know, it's always shocking to hear these stories of kids having a stroke when they were four, or a history of a brain tumor or things like that. So we do get a fair amount of families calling and their child has a history of a brain injury. And oftentimes it's helpful to have the more individualized occupational therapy approach to driver training. Sometimes these teens have tried a general driver's ed curriculum and not succeeded, or sometimes the family reaching out just to say, I don't even know if driving is in my child's future. And again, this is helping people make decisions part is something that we'll do. So we, in our readiness to drive program, the individual doesn't have to have a permit or a license yet. A big reason for that is that it can be really emotionally charged to get your permit and then be told not to drive. It's a lot of work to get your permit and get all ramped up. And so what we do, we do a 3-hour evaluation. We do more youth appropriate assessments. And then we do passenger activities with that individual. And this is really all based on the work of Miriam Monahan, who's a pioneer in this area, I would say. What it gives us the opportunity is to observe the higher level cognitive functions, mostly around visual scanning and attention, I would say, processing speed, without this person needing to have the driving skills. So if it's a brand new driver, I can't really assess the high level stuff because we're just in a parking lot. So by having this person as a passenger, I'm driving, I'm giving them very specific things that I want them to be identifying to me, problem solving. We have a whole protocol, basically. And what we've found is that gives us so much more information than just the clinical piece. So then we get back to the clinic, and sometimes the recommendation is to wait a year. Sometimes the recommendation is to work with an OT on community mobility and independence and growing up. Sometimes just kind of what needs to happen. And sometimes we come back and we're like, wow, the clinical testing wasn't great, but the skills in the car were fantastic. Let's move forward. So that's what's been really and kind of newer piece to our practice. And I feel like we all have benefited so much from the information we get from those evaluations.
That's phenomenal.
Doro?
Nobody wants to talk. Everybody's so quiet today.
No, I mean, that's yeah, readiness to drive is a big part too. I agree. We see a lot of teenagers on the autism spectrum disorder, and that's a big time underserved area right now. So many younger ones that want to drive and nobody knows how to guide them.
And it's such a part of growing up, right? It's such a part of our culture.
Rite of passage, for sure.
It's changing a little. I would say it's a little less of a focus than it used to be, like generationally, but it's a huge thing. And sometimes pieces of that are teasing out, does this teen want to drive or is it the parents who are driving? Yeah. Like there's a lot of emotional and just family dynamics, yeah, as with everything too.
Yeah. Well, this was a great conversation. Thank you for joining us. I have one last question that I would like to ask each of you.
Ask away.
So if you were going to make one recommendation or one important point of reference related to the conversation that we just had, what would it be?
I'll start. I think it would be to meet a client where they're at. So there's not one test that can say yes or no, they can or cannot drive. It's really, you have to look at the whole picture. I think that would be my main point. Everybody has such a different story, and so many different factors play into driving and driving safely. And you can't go black and white, yay or nay. I mean, in very few cases you can, but Yeah, in general, yeah, I would highly recommend if your loved one had a brain injury to look for somebody like Terry that can provide that individualized guidance and work with you and train you to maybe get back on the road safely.
Thank you. I agree with what you said, absolutely. And I think my only additional comment would be both for practitioners as well as for survivors and family members to ask questions about driving, continue to pursue the things you care about. So on the therapist side, bring it up. You don't have to know all the answers. Just bring up the questions. Like, that's kind of the initial piece, I think. And then for family members, find somebody who can help answer the questions that you have. They're out there.
Thanks. Good answers.
Thank you so much.
I love that you just said, keep asking questions. One of the things that sometimes we forget is that we don't know what we don't know. And just to be open to hearing more.
I feel like in nowadays medical model, it's hard to ask questions. If you just go to, you know, your primary care physician, you get your 15 minutes. And usually I, as a healthcare provider, go in with a list. And then, to be totally honest, I get intimidated after the second question to ask even more questions. So I can only imagine what it must feel like to some people that want to get back to driving. So nope, just ask everything you want to know. Why we're here to provide answers and to help with guidance or resources. You know,
yes,
we don't know all the answers. When we find out, we'll find resources.
Well, we've got some pretty good resources to add from today's episode. We've got Terry, yes. We'll put your website in there, and we could probably do several more episodes just based on all of the services that you provide at your clinic.
Well, thank you.
And we've got Doro. So we've got Terry in Colorado. We've got Doro in Florida. It's our little piece to the puzzle that we're adding. So thank you so much for joining us. It was a great.
Thank you for this conversation. It's a pleasure.
Thank you, Terry. It was great.
Yeah, so nice to meet you guys.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode. We appreciate your support and would love to hear from you. Ask us questions and share your thoughts by email at nogginsandneurons@gmail.com. That's noggins, the word and spelled out, neurons@gmail.com. If you like what you heard, please share this podcast with others you think will benefit. Also, be sure to subscribe and leave us a review. We'll catch you next time on Noggins and Neurons, Stroke and TBI Recovery Simplified.